introduced Anselm Hollow for another of his enlightening lectures. Anselm is revered here only in part for his famous warm chuckle. Before stating this, I decided to look in the dictionary.com to make sure that revered was really the verb that I wanted. And it said, to regard with respect, tinged with awe. Yes, I think tinged with awe is exactly it. Anselm is the type of poet who frequently receives an encore demand at his readings. If you haven't had a chance to hear him read, you should find him on the Naropa Archives, where you could also find his lectures on Dada, translation, Greek poets and their influence on modernism, language poets, and more. Some of you have had or will surely have the delight of taking a class with Anselm, or perhaps having him as your thesis advisor. You have much to look forward to. If you are lucky, he will read one of your works, in part or entire, out loud, chuckle, and say, "Yes, yes, I like that. This is a great compliment." Anselm is a collector of ideas, stories, and quotes, and more, he makes good use of them. His books are too numerous to list. I recommend Sojourner Microcosms, Pick Up the House, Corvus, Cause and Causeries, and his new and selected poems, Notes on the Possibilities and Attractions of Existence. Please sit quietly with your cell phones off and listen to Anselm Hollow.
Including the United States. So, good work. But this is from his introduction to the book. Eliot says, "All translation sends the essential message that one's own culture is not enough, and that the way to avoid intellectual stagnation is to learn from other ways of thinking about, perceiving, luxuriating and despairing in the world." This book appears at a moment, 2006, when the United States is particularly self-absorbed. Less than a fifth of its citizens have passports. And I'd like to interject here that of that fifth, probably half of them won't get their passports anytime real soon if they want to zip across the border to Mexico or Canada. A third of its high school students cannot find the Pacific Ocean on the world map. Its rulers dream without embarrassment of a global empire. Poetry, though not the salvation of the world, presents a small alternate model, an endless net of individual dialogues between writers and between writers and readers, regardless of governments, nations, and communal identities. Its books are a way out of one's world and a way into the world at large. I must say, first of all, that I feel both disqualified and overqualified to talk about the subject of translating from the Finnish or the German or Swedish or any of the literal handful of languages with which I am somewhat familiar. I never had to study Finnish or Swedish or German in the sense that other translators may have done. Such things as the intricacies of Finnish grammar, those so-called 14, or is it 19 cases, for instance, the sly variations of the passive voice, and so on and so forth. The same I can safely say applies to my knowledge of Swedish, which is the language in which I first learned to read. I grew up in Helsinki, Finland, the son of J.A. Hallo, professor of educational philosophy at the university, but also an essayist and translator of world literature into Finnish, and his wife Iris Walden, a German-speaking native of Riga, Latvia. Thus, my very first language was German. Swedish and reading came to me in the early years of World War II, when our family spent some time in Stockholm, and in the summer of 1941, my father taught me Finnish in 3 months, which was then the language of instruction in the schools I attended until my baccalaureate. My mother taught me English before the age of 10, thus before I had it as a subject in school, and also the beginnings of French. In Baltic and Scandinavian countries, that quick resume of my linguistic history does not seem all that unusual. People from small and non-imperial linguistic groups pay much more attention to the teaching of other languages than do the imperial ones. Most ancient Greeks and Romans never bothered to acquire a command of what they consider barbarian tongues, since both empires imposed their own language on conquered or assimilated peoples. To round off this relation of my personal history, I want to add that I've spent most of my adult life in the Anglophone world, in the United Kingdom and the United States. English is the language of my active life as a person and as a writer. It is the language in which I feel most thoroughly at home, whether waking or sleeping. One might say that I have translated myself physically, literally, and literarily. But my relationship with Finnish, Swedish, German, and to a lesser degree French and Spanish is still, for lack of a better term, organic enough for me to read the literature of those languages with much greater ease than I now feel trying to speak them. During my years as a lecturer at the University of Iowa's Creative Writing Program, also known as the Writer's Workshop, in the mid-60s to early 70s of the 20th century, Stavros Delagiorgis and I started the first ever translation workshop at that university with a concentration on poetry, notoriously the most impossible text to translate. Here at the Jack Kerouac School, I have for a number of years also presided over a translation workshop. Here's a brief excerpt from its course description. I think it reflects most of my basic beliefs about the art of translation. So what it said, course description says, this is a workshop based on the idea that translation equals transformation. How do the choices we make in vocabulary, style, conceptual approach, when we write anything at all, translate our thoughts into words, affect the result? How do we know that the literature in translation we read is an accurate reflection of the original? What is an accurate reflection? Can translated literature ever reach the aesthetic and emotional immediacy of texts we are able to read in their original or our own language? These are just a few of the questions we'll be examining while also attempting to create our own translations, either from languages we know or from one kind of English to another. What follows then in the prospectus is a list of texts providing some theoretical and practical background in translation studies, which seems to be an ever-expanding discipline, linguistics, anthropology, and so on. We also examine existing translations of modern classics such as Samuel Beckett's and Ron Padgett's translations of Guillaume Apollinaire's poem Zone, various translations of Rainer Maria Rilke, some of them less horrendous than some others, etc. Also included in the course description are three quotes from writers who have engaged in translation in various ways. The first one is from a 1971 essay by the late distinguished poet and essayist Octavio Paz of Mexico. He says, "Every text is unique, and at the same time, it is a translation of another text. No text is entirely original because language itself, in its essence, is already a translation. Firstly, of the non-verbal world, and secondly, since every sign and every phrase is the translation of another sign and another phrase." However, this argument can be turned around without losing any of its validity. All texts are original because every translation is distinctive. Every translation up to a certain point is an invention, and as such, it constitutes a unique text. The second one, published 10 years later, is by the great philosophical humorist Jacques Derrida of France, and I use the term humorist in an entirely complimentary sense. He's really very funny. Difference is never pure, no more so is translation. And for the notion of translation, we would have to substitute the notion of transformation. A regulated transformation of one language by another, of one text by another. We will never have, and in fact have never had, to do with some transport or pure signifieds from one language to another, or within one and the same language, that the signifying instrument would leave virgin and untouched. And the third quote, more indirect, comes from Susan Basnett McGuire, a distinguished UK theorist of translation. Here she quotes two noted Brazilian poets, one of whom I believe is still with us in his 70s. Poets and translators Haroldo and Augusto de Campos used Derrida to develop something like a postmodern and non-Eurocentric approach to translation. They refuse any sort of preordained original, but instead view translation as a form of transgression and come up with their own terms, one of which is translation as a form of cannibalism. Yet this term is not to be understood as another form of possessing the original, but as a liberating form, one which eats, digests, and frees oneself from the original. Cannibalism is to be understood not in the Western sense, i.e. that of capturing, dismembering, mutilating, and devouring, but in a sense which shows respect, i.e. as a symbolic act of taking back out of love, of absorbing the virtues of a body through a transfusion of blood. Translation is seen as an empowering act, a nourishing act, an act of affirmative play, that is very close to the Walter Benjamin Jacques Derrida position, which sees translation as a life force that ensures a literary text's survival. Yeah, that's Benjamin, actually. Benjamin says translation into at least one or maybe two other languages somehow does ensure the survival of literary texts, just because there are more versions of it in the world. It's certainly true of the Bible, which in most translations, except for the King James, is not such great literature. But just let that pass. As my father did in his day, I also believe that a good literary translation should be understood as an addition to and a part of the literature of its target language, and should be critiqued and valued as such, not merely as some kind of imported commodity. This does not mean that it should be tailored to fit any contemporary trend or fashion in the literature of the target language, at the expense of the essential strangeness that makes the source text what it is. Every language carries with it both its history and its ever-changing culture. And the more a translator knows about these, the more likely she or he is to navigate the sometimes stormy crossings of translation. And here I would like to say a few words about collaboration in translation. In certain ways, the translator is a less lonely artist than a writer who works only in the medium of her own language. She or he always enjoys the good, if not always perfect, company of the author to be translated, and may even experience a kind of mystical union with that author. Late friend Paul Blackburn, poet and translator of the Provençal Troubadours, used to say that translating was very much like acting. One had to assume the role of the author to be translated, sometimes across oceans, continents, and centuries. And in Paul's case, with a little good Spanish brandy. Taking a perhaps less romantic view, the French Royaumont Foundation has sponsored gatherings of 5 or 6 French authors in a converted monastery lasting a week or two, to which they invite authors working in other languages, as for instance English, with the project of translating a short work, mostly poetry, collectively into French. The guest author is an active participant in day-long meetings and arguments that the hosts collectively discuss and produce a translation, which is then published in a small but elegant edition. For a few years, a reciprocal arrangement functioned at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, and I was invited to participate. My initial skepticism about such translation by committee was soon dispelled. It was actually a terrific experience to work on a text in the company of others, like the translation workshops at Naropa. It brought out the incipient humor, the absurdity, the adventurous nature of translation as such, in a way that working on a text by oneself does only once in a while. Such occasions do, of course, depend on a great deal of organizational goodwill and funding. Typically, the American end of this Wyoming program evaporated after 3 or 4 years. The French financial contribution to it ended when the university could not find a way to publish any of the work that had been translated. And the French department couldn't agree on it either. And they probably don't get paid enough to just pass the hat and just do it, you know. Poetry, especially contemporary poetry in translation, ranks as the absolute worst seller in the American book market, which has become a branch of the entertainment industry, quite literally. An industry that expects far greater returns on product than publishers ever expected in bygone days. On a smaller scale, many translators I know have had valuable collaborators in writers or editors working in the source language. A few years ago, I collaborated with the Naropa alumna poet Laura Wright and French scholar David Ball on her translation of Belgian-born French poet Henri Michaud's book, Life in the Folds, an important collection of poems still awaiting publication. And here I'd like to insert what looks like a poem, but well, it's a text, by Charles Bernstein, American poet, critic, and so forth, who collaborated with a Chinese poet, Ziqing Zhang, who translated poems from his work into Chinese. And what this text is, it's based on a letter from the translator. And, you know, it's actually pretty interesting. What do you mean by rashes of ash? Is industry systematic work, assiduous activity, or ownership of factories? Is ripple agitate lightly? Are we tossed in tune when we write poems? And what or who emboss with gloss insignias of air? Is the fabric about which you write in the epigraph of your poem an edifice, a symbol of heaven? Does freight refer to cargo or lading carried for pay by water, land, or air? Or does it mean payment for such transportation or a freight train? When you say a commoded journey, do you mean a comfortable journey or a good train with well-equipped commodities? But then why do you drop the A before slumberous friend? And when you write in Why I Am Not a Christian, you always throw it down, but you never pick it up. What is it? In the harbor of illusion, does vain refer to a person's vein under his skin? Or is it a metaphor for a river? Does lot mean one's fate or a piece of land? And does camphor refer to camphor trees? Moreover, who or what is nearing? Who or what has fell? Or does fell refer to the skin or hide of an animal? And who or what has stalled? Then is the thoroughfare of Noon's Etal an equivalent of the template? Is fear of flipping? Does flipping mean crazy? How about strain? Does it mean a severe trying or wearing pressure or effect such as a strain of hard work or a passage as in a piece of music? Does mercury refer to a brand of oil? In the lines, shards of bucolic pastry anchored against cactus cabinets, Nantucket buckets. Could we take it as pieces of pies or tarts are placed in buckets, which are made of wood from Nantucket, anchored against cabinets, small rooms or furniture, with cactus? What is not flack? I suppose the caucus of Caucasians refers to the white people's meeting of a political party to nominate candidates. That's actually right on. But who is Uncle Hodgepodge? And what does familiar freight to the returning antelope mean? You're right, the walls are our floors. How can the walls be floors if the floors refer to the part of the room which forms its enclosing surface and upon which one walks? In, and the floors like balls repel all falls. Does balls refer to nonsense or to any ball like a basketball or to guys or to a social assembly for dancing? Falls means to descend from a higher to a lower or to drop down wounded or dead. But what is the so-called overall mesh? Is the garbage heap in the ordinary sense? Why does garbage heap exchange for so-called overall mesh? Since a faker is one who fakes, how can arbitrary reduce to faker? Who or what are disappointed not to have been? This gets quite metaphysical at times. Does frames refer to form, constitution, or structure in general, or to a particular status of the mind? In the sentence, if you don't like it colored in, you can always Xerox it and see it all gray. What is it? What does colored in mean? A few lines later you write, you mean image farm when you've got bratwurst. Does bratwurst refer to sausage? Does the line mean the sausage you saw reminded you of a farm which you imagined? Does fat bottom boats refer to boats with thick bottoms? Is humble then humped used to describe the actions of one who plays golf. In the phrase, a sideshow freak, the freak refers to a hippie. Sideshow refers to secondary importance. I mean, this guy's command of English is extraordinary, actually. Or an abnormal actor in the sideshow. Then, who or what is linked with Steam of Pink? And how about the tongue-tied tightrope stalker? Does the stalker refer to one who is pursuing stealthily in the act of hunting game? The stalker is a witness at first and then a witless witness. You write, the husks are salted. What kind of nut husks can be salted for eating? What does bending mean? To become curved, crooked, or bent, or to bow down in submission or reverence, yield, submit? Does bells refer to metallic sounding instruments or a kind of trousers? Just a few lines later, you have the phrase, felt very poor. Who felt poor? Toys? Is humming in the sense of humming a song stepped into where? Not being part of what? In no pastrami. Walt, I'm with you in Sydney, where the echoes of the Mamaroneck howl down the outback's pixelating corridors. Does the pastrami refer to a highly seasoned shoulder cut of beef? Is Mamaroneck a place in the U.S. where wild oxes howl? I take it corridors refers to the passageway in the supermarket. Could I read the poem as, the speaker is doing shopping in a supermarket in Sydney. He is walking along the eccentric passageways among the shelves on which goods are placed. He does not want to buy the pastrami, as he seems to have heard the echoes of wild oxes howling in the United States while he addresses Baldwin. In no end to envy, does the envy refer to admire or in the bad sense? Well, I think it's just a wonderful example of what translators deal with, you know, and how great it is. I mean, Bernstein has not published his responses. They're probably much less interesting. or just basically footnotes to this. And a little about my personal experience of translating from Finnish into English, with a couple, I hope, at least mildly amusing anecdotal instances. Since I've been working mainly from texts by contemporary Finnish and Finland-Swedish authors, I have little to say about translating from classics or traditional literature. Cultural and linguistic differences, however, may present problems even in contemporary texts. While translating Antikuri's novel, Pohjanma, A Bay in Ostrobosnia, the translation appeared earlier this year, about 4 years ago, from Aspasia Books in Toronto. It's a novel which is set in small-town Finland of the 1970s, and in it, I came across the term leipäparras. While this thing does not, as an object, exist any longer in very many Finnish homes, it is still immediately recognizable to a Finnish reader as the word for a pole reaching from one wall to another under the ceiling of a farmhouse kitchen. Onto this pole, a great number of flat loaves of rye bread with a hole in the middle would be strung after a baking session, be taken down when needed. Finnish-English dictionaries provide a simple literal translation, bread pole, which does not conjure up any sort of comprehensible image in an anglophone reader's mind. What to do? Clumsy as it may look in a work of fiction, a footnote was the only solution. That was simply a question of connotation. Then there was a case of the butterfly versus the moth. it was more complicated, and it had to do with the diverging auras words may have in different languages. Some years ago, so long ago that I cannot recall the author's name, I translated a sample chapter of a novel in which moths, those butterflies that only become active after dark, played an important role. The original text referred to these creatures as night butterflies, yöperhoset, which is what they're called in Finnish. Parenthetically, yöperhoset also has another connotation, that of the euphemistic English lady of the night. A bit reminiscent of H.G. Wells's Dr. Moreau's Island, the novel had a mad scientist plot, and those moths were mentioned on almost every page. When the author read my translation, she was mortified. Her mysterious night butterflies had turned into prosaic moths, which to a Finnish ear only refers to koi, the small pale species of moth that destroys people's woolen goods and clothes. Our correspondence ended on my part on a regretful note. Given the contemporary and scientific parameters of the narrative, there was not much to be done, since night butterflies really do not exist as such in the lexicon of Anglophone zoology. Finally, a brief set of examples from my translation of the great Finnish poet, late great Finnish poet, Pentti Saarikoski's last book, The Arnia Sarja, which after more than 10 years of looking for a United States publisher, saw the light a few years ago as trilogy from La Alameda Press, a terrific independent press in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Häntä, jonka kasvot ovat jo kiveä, hän katsoo niin, ettei häntä kuuntele. Him whose face already is stone, his eyes are such one doesn't listen to him. Here the problem is or was the verb katsoo, an active form of looking, i.e. literally, he looketh so. Or his manner of looking is such that one does not listen to him. So it seemed reasonable to take the leap to eyes. His eyes are such, one doesn't listen to him. Kaarelle pöydälle levitän vanhat tarut, kilvet ja keihäät ja tulta syöksyvät hartia. Over two tables I spread out the old stories, shields and spears and flame throwing. Tulta syöksyvät hartiat, derived from a Homeric metaphor, means quite literally flame-throwing shoulders. And even though the flamethrower is a modern weapon, I suspect that Pentti would have agreed with that energetic anachronism. In fact, the passage refers to him working on translation of the Odyssey. Tuulen koukertamat, pakkasen jäykistämät vaatekappaleet riippuvat narulta kuin sunscreenin terveen. garments twisted by wind, stiffened by frost, hang on the line like Sanskrit characters. This just an example of word order. While modern Finnish grammar was constructed according to classical and Germanic models, or one might say these were imposed on it, there are moments when the syntax of the original cannot be preserved. Twisted by wind, stiffened by frost, garments would sound much more odd than the Finnish line. Elvis raakkuu ja rokkaa, kukaan ei tajua mitä hän tahtoo sanoa. Että minä luovutan, panen pellit kiinni, kun uunissa vielä on tuli. Elvis croaks and rolls, no one perceives what he wants to say, which is, I give up. Let the engine run in the closed garage. The literal translation of the last three lines says something like, that I give up, close the dampers while there is still fire in the stove. It's a bit of a shame to lose the cross-cultural leap in the Finnish from Elvis Presley to old-fashioned Scandinavian tile or brick stoves, but very few of today's Anglophone readers even know what a damper is. It's basically a valve that lets air in so the fire will go out, because that's more. It seemed better to translate the suicidal carbon monoxide image into one instantly recognizable by a contemporary reader. And finally, a couple of quotations from distinguished translators from both the distant and more recent past. The first one is from Anne Lefebvre, dated 1654 to 1720, better known during her lifetime as Anne Dacier, a French scholar and translator of the Greek classics, including Homer. In the introduction to her translation of the Iliad, published in 1699, she addresses, quote, certain people who tend to have a very unflattering and highly erroneous idea of what translations are. They imagine translation to be a servile imitation, in which the flowering of the spirit and the imagination have no part to play. In a word, they think translation is not creative. That is surely an immense mistake. A translation is not a copy of a painting in which the copier is willing to follow the lines, the proportions, the shapes, the attitudes of the original he imitates. A good translator does not work under such constraints. At most, he is like a sculptor who tries to recreate the work of a painter, or like a painter who tries to recreate the work of a sculptor. Bad translations render the letter without the spirit, a low and servile imitation. Good translations keep the spirit without moving away from the letter. They are free and noble imitations that turn the familiar into something new. My second quote comes from the late English poet Peter Wiggam, translator of Catullus, Martial, Sappho, and others. In fact, his Catullus was William Carlos Williams' favorite version. It's still in print, as far as I know. In 1980, Peter Wiggam composed 17 Do's and Don'ts of the translation. Here are a couple. Treat proper names with great deference. Each man is a poet when he names his cat, said Horn. No poet but does not delight in proper names. Homer's list of ships, Villon's twin ballads of the dead queens and dead lords. Every child is aware that names carry with them power over the objects they denote. If translation all too often seems from beginning to end nothing more than an interminable succession of choices between an infinite variety of evils, it, the act of possession it represents, is also the only way we can lay claim to the experience from the inside, what is not our own. The translator is no mere translator, nor are the poems he makes mere translations. We know that we shall wake with the work done to find that the one we have loved and lived with and learned to treat as ourselves has remained intractably inviolate after all. but while the artwork we shall, like any other artist, have beaten back temporality. Thank you.
Which of all the languages you know do you actively think in?
English.
Just English?
Yeah. Actively for now.
But I mean, when you're translating from German to English, when you're reading in the German, you're thinking German, aren't you?
Yeah, of course. I'm thinking along in
okay.
the German.
Okay. What's that moment when you click from the German into the English? Is that like just stepping through a door, or what's that feeling?
Well, if I'm not planning on translating it, I just keep going. There's no click there. Obviously, if I have to think about rendering the German sentence or line into English, I...
So you don't feel an alteration in yourself when
yeah.
you move from one language to the other?
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, but they're not entirely. There was a funny 18th century sort of drawings about how bilingualism worked. You know, like do we have two little reservoirs there, or two or three, or whatever, however many, and is there a little valve which we turn in order to, you know,
let some. Did you read Rilke in the original?
Pardon?
You lucky duck.
Well, I mean, James Thurber said when someone, I think, where this was, maybe it was in the former Czechoslovakia, now the Czech Republic, somebody approached him and said she really thought that she'd read him in Czech and she found his work marvelous. Thurber said, was sort of a cranky guy. He said, yes, my work suffers in the original.
Hi, Alyssa Martinez. I had a question. I was wondering if you could talk about when you're translating the ideas of rhythm of the original text and the rhyming and that kind of thing, and how you're able to translate that.
I didn't bring Peter Williams to the book. What he says about that is that you can obviously, I mean, languages have very different sound qualities, you know. But and he talks mostly about translating poetry, there is a, even when the work is in some ways Dadaist, hard to penetrate as Charles Peirce is, but there is a kind of rhythm. I think he refers to it as a thought rhythm in any given language, and that is really the best you can hope for to match. You know, in other words, there is a certain. It's less an oral sound cadence than actually, you know. A way of dealing with syntax and with arranging the thoughts, metaphors, images, etc., in a line or a paragraph. So as long as you catch that, it's the best you can hope for. Of course, I mean there's a great form of mistranslation, so-called mistranslation, where you treat the original text as if it were just some weird kind of English, you know. And it works quite well with French, for instance, because they're still relatively cognate and close languages, which, you know, you can have really
heart. it's not a translation, it's a version of some sort, you know. A homeophonic translation. So it's sort of gives you another word for that. That answers your question.
Kelly Sexton. When it comes to translation, I always think about how authorial intent can get skewed. How, you know, like the night butterflies. Night butterflies are not moths to the author. And I'm wondering what sort of issues these cause between the translator and the author, and how those are sort of rectified through discussion and more.
I didn't quite hear you. Did you could just speak up or
something?
I'm sorry. What do you think is that? What's the
issue? The issue between the translator and the author when the author has first received the translation expressively for the night. As with the night butterflies.
As with what?
The night butterflies.
Oh, the night butterflies, yeah, right. Well, I mean, I haven't had any arguments with authors saying, well, I mean, that wasn't really an argument. That was just, I mean, saying, sorry, I don't think that this will work very well. And I don't think that that book has been translated. That way, I suppose, vocabulary, agreed upon vocabulary in one language, in the source language, may present difficulties in the target language. That may be almost insuperable. You can't really get over them. But I think otherwise the notorious case of an author vehemently disagreeing with his first translators into English was Milan Kundera, the Unbearable Lightness of Being and so forth, who actually was able to exert sufficient pressure to have, I think it was his first three novels, have them retranslated by someone he approved of. I never compared them, so who knows? But, you know, I mean, I guess he, by that time he made enough money to bring lawsuits and so forth. So.
Hi, Monica, another way. A question about the link between translation theory and the practice of translation. There's so much emphasis, contemporary emphasis on translation theory, and so much interest in it, and it just, as you said at the beginning of the talk, it's a field that's expanding, and there's so much interest in it. And as a person who translates as well, I find it very hard to establish a link between the actual practice and the theory. And also, so the question is, twofolded. Is there such a thing as a theory that you could universally apply to every single work that you translate? Or does your approach have to vary and be tailored and be in synchrony with a particular work? And I was wondering if you could talk about that process.
Well, I think translation theory is largely really an investigation into the nature of source texts, for instance. You know, I mean, what's their background, what's their temporal, spatial, and local, whatever, resonance is, and how certain interpretations, then, of the source text might be biased in a way, or slanted, let's say, that does not quite conform. I mean, that nothing can ever quite conform. I mean, there's no equal sign between the source text and the target text. It's, because they're both, as Paz says, independent texts, you know. But I think that's mostly, I mean, I've read a bunch of it, and it's interesting to follow how it has sort of evolved through time. You know, I think the first, well, that is, there were Roman authors who discussed it
But you know, it's not really, it doesn't really, it's like a lot of theory. That's it. Yeah, a lot of theory, it sort of proves that you've been correct in thinking the way you've been thinking all along. experience at best. You know. And I'm glad that you know, it obviously gives the idea of translation, the concept of translation, the kind of dignity that it may not have had before really got going in the mid 20th century as a real discipline. But otherwise, I think you still have to trust your ear and your knowledge of the source and luck, you know.
Thank you.
Hi, Deirdre. I was just wondering how working as a translator and translating so many other people's texts has changed the way you write or like the way you view language, I guess.
Well, it's a good one. It's a good question, but it's a hard one too, because you know, it's whatever, and it depends. Again, you know, it depends on whether you're. I never really had to translate. Well, I guess for a while there, I did for a while. Depend on it as income, i.e., like the groceries. It's a job, you know. I mean, it's a job. Obviously, the people you choose yourself, you know, to translate, unless you know it's not a commission, or you commission yourself to do it, then I'm sure there must be some influence. Or one seeks out. I mean, Sarikoski, for instance. You know, I sometimes feel like I could have written his poems too. You know. So it's that close. There is a kind of elective affinity there. Whereas on the other hand, I've translated sort of the grand old man of Finnish poetry, Paavo Haavikko, who is, you know, a great, quite insufferable, cynical snob. But I guess I have traits of that too, but who doesn't? But I would not feel that I could have written his work. Does that sort of act different?
Yeah. Kelly Davies, you ever feel like she might get afraid that you don't, that you might get the words that they were trying to say or what they were trying to say wrong? What he was trying to say, what if what you say isn't what he wants to say?
Yeah, I'm trying to, obviously that's what
it must be. For instance, like, want to try really hard to like not get it wrong, because I mean, what if he was like sitting there for like 12 days and then some guy comes along 10,000 years later and
says, what does get it wrong? Well, tough shit, you know. One tries, what's best?
Yeah. Just try hard.
Well, it's not that hard if you have a head for it, you know. Yeah. I can't skateboard, you know.
Sam Knights for the Archive. As Malayev, we had a conversation with Andrew Schelling once about translation, and he told me in his years of translating, he used to disregard theory, and that you had introduced him to some critical texts that really changed his mindset on that subject. And I was hoping that you might be able to share a couple of titles, if not one, that you felt is very resonant on the topic and we could all benefit from.
You mean theoretical texts?
Sure.
Well, I mean, I quoted Paz and Derrida, and Benjamin is very interesting. Walter Benjamin is also very interesting on the idea
concepts are sort of pre-postmodern concepts, like pure translation, you know, pure poetry. But and so we find it in interesting ways. But the one thing that I got from him was, and again, it seemed like a bit, like I know that all along already, but was that one must not try to smooth. If the source text has sort of rough spots, and if they're intentional, if they're not due to, you know, lack of talent or lack of attention, but if it has intentional rough spots and you know, vivid but sort of startling elements in it, then one should try one's best to have the translation have those too, have those as well. So for instance, I mean, an example that comes to mind would be, or has been cited, where Constance Garnett's otherwise wonderfully readable translations from the Russian, where later translators have been, and scholars have pointed out that that she makes Russia, the Dostoevsky's and Tolstoy's and so forth, Russia seem a little bit like life at English country houses in the 1910s and 20s, which is comforting, I guess, you know, in a way. I mean, I totally enjoy reading those. But yeah, I mean, that can happen. That would sort of be, that would be a no-no in Benjamin's view. You know, if Dostoevsky is not a great stylist, well, don't try to make him one.
Richard Schwartz, hi, Tim. A couple days ago on the faculty panel, there was a lot of talk about subordinate and dominant language and culture, and the act of translation having a dynamic in which one is potentially absorbed into the other. And I just wondered if you had any sense of that in your work, in your career. I don't know how that would maybe apply between Finnish and English.
Subordination, appropriation, is that sort of, those are the things that you were discussing. Well, yeah, I mean, there is obviously has always been some of that going on. I mean, say between Rome and Greece, you know, I mean, the Romans were wonderful imitators, but they got their architecture and they got a lot of their literature, especially poetry, from the Greeks. You know, so you could call that cultural appropriation, especially after the Hellenistic Empire sort of folded. The Roman Empire was the one.
So are we the Romans now?
Pardon?
Are we the Romans now?
Well, to some extent, yes, I think so. I think so. But on the other hand, we're not really very interested, you know, as I said, Germany, France, Italy, and Spain translate many more books from American and English publishers than we do from any of those countries. And it's not as if, and those are big countries, major countries with lots of writers, like Russia as well. So the empire's interest has always been somewhat interested mainly for political reasons. I mean, what's going on over there? Let's get someone to translate this for us, you know. And of course, yeah, I mean, I think anyone under the age of 12 should now start studying Arabic. And I'm not kidding. And Farsi as well. Because, you know, as long as we can't tell whether President Ahmadinejad is saying that Israel should be wiped off the map, or was he actually just saying that
it should be deleted from the page of time, which I think is wonderful. Like, that's what you say in Farsi, but the colloquial translation has been wiped off of that. And I think there's a distinction there that is worth investigating. The pages of time. I don't know.
Hi, Amy Huff. I was just wondering if you could speak about the logistics of the career, getting into the career of translation, and what that involves, how to make like connections with the authors, and if schooling is necessary for it, or if it's more kind of like a freelance thing you can start up on your own.
Connection with the author?
Or like how to get into the career of translation, like how you start off on that path.
Career? It's not really, okay, I know, I hear what you guys are saying. No, I mean, in my case, it was sort of genetic or something, where I just grew up in a house where four or five languages were spoken, you know, and books in all of those were on the shelves. So, you know, I mean, I never really thought of it as a career, actually.
Kind of fell in your lap, or I mean, for somebody who speaks two languages, like I speak Italian, so for wanting to get into translating from Italian to English, how do you start that process?
Well, it depends on the language, I suppose, too. The problem with the supermarket culture of the book trade, now publishing business too, is that there's very few editors anymore who actually can read French, or read German, or read Italian, even, or Spanish. So they used to be, it used to be editors, foreign language editors in American publishing houses, who would recommend books, say, well, maybe you should look at this. And that sort of almost gone. I mean, it's all the Frankfurt Derby book fair, where European publishers try their damnedest to hawk their wares to American and other publishers, other languages. So it's a tough business. I mean, it has been said that. Translators, and I think some translators have done so, should take a more active part in the selection of authors. But there again, it's a question of reaching someone in the publishing hierarchy who is willing to listen or willing to pay attention, or is so impressed by your sample from your letter's work that say, oh yeah, but I mean, it's almost, I mean, you probably should have an agent to get you that kind of entree. It's tough. University presses, of course, are, they may be more welcoming.
That's a dull question. I had just a comment that what you're saying about translation and about the ways in which there's a contrast between those translators who want to restitute the original in some ideal sense, and those who realize that any translation is a recreation and a network, exactly parallels what goes on in archaeology and art history, which is trying to reconstruct some original idea that's needed to be expressed. And so you get this endless circuit of back and forth between a Pantheridian and a pre-postmodern kind of attitude. It's amazing, it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, no, that's quite true. In fact, the French woman who translated Homer, Sappho, you name it, into French in the late 17th century, they were prose translations. She didn't even try. And she had a big argument then with, I forget the guy's name, who did a kind of potted Iliad, but it rhymed. and he claimed that his was much more, like the original, right? and they're finally being friends, but they have an extended polemic over this
question. I just want to say thank you, and thank you to you all, and remind you that the poetry chat with Allison Hicks Clayton starting upstairs in Shambhala Hall at 4:15. So we will see you later. Thank you, Anselm.